Chapter 42. Dust. Evrom's watch guards the desert road, Rojva says. It is the last village before we cross into the waste.
Read about it in Dad's old messenger journals, I say. Called Lookout Hill back then. On a clear day, you can see miles into the desert from the hilltop.
Oh, I'd like to see that, Selin says.
We'll camp there tonight, I say, even if it costs a few hours.
That will not be possible, Rojva says. Why not? I ask. But before she answers, we round a bend, and I see the town in the distance. To the others, it's still a speck on the horizon, but to my eyes, it's just up the road. One of Dad's better journal illustrations was an idyllic watercolour of Lookout Hill.
I used to stare at it for hours. A lonely watchtower atop a proud hill with a small town at its base, overlooking a line of wayposts shrinking and fading into the endless sandy flats of the waste until they touched the pink and blue horizon of a setting sun. The colours were so vivid, I felt like I'd been there myself. I'd been hoping that seeing that tower in real life would make me feel a little closer to him. But Dad made that painting before the Crazians came. The lonely watchtower is gone, replaced by a walled fort that dominates the entire hilltop, flying the scorpion banner of the Mehending tribe. The fort's thick walls are lined with crenellations for archers, rockslingers, and scorpions, gigantic crankbows that fire stingers 3 times the size of a Sharoom spear. 5 tall watchtowers look out over the town below, standing silent guardian over the wayposts disappearing into the waste.
They gonna let us pass without a problem? I ask.
The Mehending guard against enemies from the waste, not fools walking into it, Rojva says. In any event, they will not hinder emissaries travelling under the royal seal. I look over at her.
Since when do we have a royal seal?
Rojva shrugs. A hint of smile quirks her lips, and beneath the jasmine perfume she smells of satisfaction.
I had Arik bat his eyes at one of the palace clerks and ask after her mother.
I had all the time in the world to borrow the seal and return it.
The woman talked for hours,
Arik growls, and Selim barks a laugh. Rojva takes the lead when we reach the town. She gives a false name and produces the writ from the throne empowering her and her entourage, a Sharoom bodyguard and 2 Cheen servants, to cross the desert and treat with a Maja. I can tell Selin chafes at the servant's role, but I'm happy to keep my head down and my mouth shut. We don't linger, setting immediately through the gate and onto the desert road, even as evening approaches. The wayposts, great stone obelisks cut deep with wards, grant islands of succour, even as they lead the way through a featureless land.
They're watching us, I say, as we make camp at the first waypost.
Looking back at the towers, I can see the guards spying on us with their distance lenses.
It is their duty to watch over the desert road, Arik says.
And the eyes on this side we've got to worry over, Selin says.
Indeed, Rojva says. The Maja will have Tzars on the road to the city, and towers that can see far.
How do we avoid being seen? I ask.
We don't, unless we leave the road, and we would be fools to do that. We have the seal of royal messengers. Let them see us coming, and take us right to the Damaji.
Aye, Selin says. Except every messenger that's gone into the desert for the last 15 summers ain't been seen again.
It is a crime against Evrom to harm a messenger, Rojva says. No doubt they are safe in a silk prison.
Like your grandmum kept us, I note.
Rojva smiles. And we see how well that held you.
With no thick Crasian curtains to block the light, I wake well before dawn, feeling the sun's approach like a weight on my chest. It unsettles folk to see me at my normal speed, but the others are still asleep, so there's no need to act slow. The animals startle, suddenly discovering food in front of them. I saddle Duskrunner, stow in my pack and sleeping roll while he's still eating. I lead him to the western side of the obelisk, where we will be in shadow for sunrise. Among the supplies Arben provided for the desert crossing are canopies for our saddles. Stout canvas on simple poles to grant shade to horse and rider both. I set mine up and take care of my necessaries, climbing into the saddle before the others begin to stir.
feel like I'm a blob of butter, waiting for the skillet to heat. Slowly, the sun crests the horizon, flooding the flat plain with light. It feels like fire, closing in from all sides. I don't mind heat, or cold for that matter. I love feeling the change of seasons on my skin, but winter or summer, I burn quickly in bright sun. A shine that might turn other folk a little pink leaves me red and blistered. Even the scant bit of light that penetrates the shade in my clothes is enough to itch. The loose Crasian clothes make sense now, allowing bodies to breathe while shielding skin from the beating sun. I button up my jacket and wind the scarf over my face and head, leaving only a thin icelet. I put on my gloves and I strap into the saddle, dozing away the early hours as Duskrunner follows the other horses across flatlands of clay, cracked by the baking sun. The cracked flats go as far as the eye can see, like a flagstone path to infinity. My compass and the sun might point us in the right direction, but without the wayposts, we'd quickly lose the path and risk wandering in the desert until our stores ran out. "Thought the desert was supposed to be sand," Selen grumbles after a long day of trudging. Rojva snorts. "Did you expect a perfect line where the lush grasses of the Greenlands turn suddenly to grit?" She's trying to get a rise out of Selen, and I can smell it working. "We're in a dried up lake bed," I cut in before Selen can retort. "Should get to the other side tomorrow. That's when you'll start finding sand in your shoes." Rojva looks at me in surprise. "How do you know so much?" "Dad made the messenger run from Fort Risen to Fort Crasier for years," I say. "Crossed the desert more than a dozen times, and wrote about it in his journals. Read those books over and over, trying to know him better." Selen loosens her scarf to wipe sweat from her brow. "What's there to say? Apart from it's hot and everything's dead." "Everything ain't dead." I take a deep breath, letting the silk filter out the clouds of clay dust in the air. "There's life here. I can smell it. Sleeping like a bear in winter, but it's there, waiting for the rain to come and wake it up, if only for a while." "Alagai blood," Arik mutters under his breath, too low for the others to hear. "What's that, Arik?" I ask cheerfully, turning all eyes his way. Arik smiles at me.
Just clearing my throat, cousin."
Selen and Rojva ride with their canopies up, but Arik leaves his stowed, even as the sun beats down on his head. His skin isn't as vulnerable as mine, but he is pale by Crasian standards, and likely no friend to the sun. He has wrapped himself carefully in his charoon blacks, but he doesn't seem uncomfortable. He smells proud. "Don't know how you can wear black in this sun," Selen says. "Doesn't it just absorb the heat?" "I've dreamed of wearing the black for my entire life," Arik says. "I was in my mother's belly when she defended the walls of Everarm's reservoir from the Alagai. There wasn't a boy my age who could stand against me in the practice yard. But one by one, they were all called to Sharaj, while I was left behind." He spreads his arms, lifting his face to the sun. "Now, at last, I am free to be who I really am. And no sun is going to make me hide or drive me back into a jester's robes." We make camp under another of the ancient obelisks. Da's journals say the wayposts project a forbidding 20 paces in every direction, enough to shelter a small caravan. The horses are hobbled and blinded. The saddle canopies, drawn with great wards of unsight, have been raised to hide them from above. The Mehending lands were hunted clean of demons, but almost 2 days into the waste, we've crossed from their protection. At dusk, the heat leaches from the ground and dissipates, leaving a cold that bites like a winter night. I don't mind the chill, because it brings power. My night eyes come to life as magic seeps up from the ground to drift along the flats like a low, rolling fog. Drawn to the wards, the magic flows through us on its way to the waypost. The others barely notice, but for me it's like jumping into the swimming hole on a hot day. Power clings to me, like coming out wet. I reach out with my expanding senses, but even with night eyes and bat ears, The demons get uncomfortably close before I spot them. Corlings have brighter auras than surface creatures, but they've evolved to mask it by adapting to the terrain they hunt. Swamp and bog demons hide underwater and in trees. Wind demons keep to the clouds. Wood demons have armor so thick the outer layers are hardened and magic dead, masking the strength within. Clay demons remind me of the turtles Mam taught me to catch by the brook. Tough, muscular bodies encased in a hard shell, the exact color of the flats all around us. Thick and magic dead. Drawn to the light of our fire, they stalk in on short, thick limbs. Slow and silent. But Da wrote, they can be terrible fast when they charge, butting their blunt, armored heads hard enough to shatter stone. They don't have teeth, precisely, just a sharp beak of armor to crush and sever chunks to swallow whole. Their retractable claws can tunnel through most anything, including steel armor plate. I pull Mam's cloak of unsight closer around me as they take their time, circling the camp to view it from all sides before closing in. I string my bow and take an arrow from my quiver, but I don't know what good it will do. The demon's shells are blunt and smooth, giving no magic to power the piercing wards on the arrowheads. Anything other than a direct hit will just skitter off, and even a perfect shot might shatter against the shell. Felon sees me knock the arrow and comes over. She has her armor plates in, but they don't seem to hinder her easy grace. Even her helmet is unobtrusive, hidden beneath the scarf covering her head, save for the warded rim that grants her ward sight. Her cloak of unsight is draped around her, wards glowing softly as they shield her from the demon eyes. She scans the night, smelling of frustration. You see something? Four of them, I say, circling in close. Everyone looks, but I can tell none of them see. The demons are in no hurry, and the wait is agonizing before, at last, Arik points at one of them. There. He steps forward for a closer look. Stay close to the waypost, brother, Rojva says. Even her white robes have started to orange at the hems from the clay dust, but the shawl she's placed over her shoulders is stark white, stitched in silver thread with wards of unsight, much like those on our cloaks. Like Selen and I, she is invisible to demons. Arik is not. The protection extends 20 paces. Arik takes 19 precise paces forward, peering into the night for a better look at the foe. His shield is at the ready, and he grips the spear so tightly I can hear his muscles creak. He smells of adrenaline, excitement, and hunger. Nothing to gain picking a fight tonight, Arik, I say before he does something wood-headed. You said yourself there are only four of them. Arik flexes his arms and shoulders, limbering his muscles. We could kill them and have done. Have you lost your mind? Selen asks. 50 miles from the nearest earshot, and you want to fight callings when you don't have to. My brother has not learned to fear the Alagai, Rojva says. Too many tales of glory, too little experience. Arik rolls his eyes. My sister speaks as if she's ever seen more than an Alagai's boiled bones. Ain't wrong, though, I say. One thing to stare down a demon over the wards, or watch one dance to your tune. Seeing one cripple your friend and come racing at you with bloody talons is something different. As if on cue, the demon Arik was eyeing suddenly charges. It does not look agile, but even I am shocked by its speed as it lowers its blunt armoured head and horns, smashing heavily against the forbidding. Silver light flashes just before the demon smashes into Arik, the light bowing in midair, stopping the charge and throwing the demon back. Arik, for all his courage and hunger to prove himself, is caught off guard at the sudden assault. He gives a cry and stumbles back, just as the wards activate, thrown off balance as the anticipated blow never comes. He lands on his backside, spear and shield clattering, but no one laughs. Another clay demon strikes the wards even as the first shakes itself off and rolls back to its feet. Growling, it digs claws into the clay, readying for another charge. The horses whinny in fear, pulling at the stakes, drawing the cries of yet more demons in the distance. "Standing there without a cloak, you're calling them like a bell at supper time," I tell Arik as he gets to his feet, murder in his eyes.
"Arik Asu Sikva,"
Roshva snaps, and the mention of his mother gets her brother's attention. "A Sharum's duty is to defend their people, not to seek battle for the sake of foolish pride and lust for Ica. We have a week at least left in the crossing. Will you leave us to attempt it without our strongest fighter?"
"You assume I will die, sister?"
Arik growls.
"I assume you will act with discipline," Roshva retorts. "Not shame your mother by throwing yourself at Alagai Talons the first chance you get."
Arik scowls, but he breathes away his anger and returns to the obelisk, setting down his spear and shield. He opens his Kamange case and rosins the bow, bracing the instrument's spiked end on a thick leather band that wraps around his thigh. The bow seems flimsy and delicate in his big hand. His meaty fingers are less nimble than mine, but they move with workmanlike competence over the strings as he plays his father, Roger Halfgrip's, most famous composition, The Song of Waning. Don't know what I expected, but Arik's playing is short of it. He gets all the notes right, but Harry Roller could play circles around him. Night. I've heard backyard jug bands in Tibet's brook play with more spirit. Still, the defensive field Arik weaves around us is undeniable. The clay demons cease trying to batter through the wards and back away. There's a cry from above, and a great flap of leathern wings as a silently circling wind demon flies off in search of other prey.
"How come you don't have a warded cloak?" Selen asks.
"He does," Roshva crosses her arms.
"A cloak with a legend all its own, but he refuses to wear it."
"Halfgrip's motley cloak," I breathe. "Arik's dad's a bit of a hero to me. He saved almost as many lives as mine, but he did it without fighting anyone. Just his fiddle and his magic cloak."
"Well, if you love it so much, you wear it," Arik growls. "As soon as wear your white Dharma Ting shawl."
Roshva remains outwardly calm, but her scent is angry now.
"Would that I could, brother. This trip frees you to dress as you please, but I can hardly slip unnoticed into Maja lands in the clothing I favour. They would stone me for a hisar."
"The Maja will treat a Greenland jongleur with no more respect than a hisar," Arik says.
"At least you like to perform. Come. Sing so I can put this cursed instrument down."
Roshva still smells of irritation, but she kneels beside her brother and lowers her veil. She begins to hum, building tension in the air, before vocalizing a series of notes that weave into Arik's melody, at first matching him, then, as Roshva touches the choker at her throat, overwhelming the Kamange. Then she begins to sing. If Arik was a workman, his sister is an artisan. Roshva effortlessly delivers a song with passion and power that her brother could never have mustered, laying a musical spell over the camp that has a noticeable effect. Arik drove the demons back, but they drifted at the edge of the music, auras still predatory, waiting for the protection to wane. Roshva's music calms the demons' auras, and they lose interest, taking no more notice of us than they would if we all wore cloaks of unsight. Arik doesn't waste time, taking bow from string and tucking his Kamange back into his case. He smells of shame, anger, and jealousy all at once. It's clear he wants no part of whatever his sister is building. But I do. Her song calls to me, thrumming in my blood, resonating in my bones. I wonder if this is how the callings felt when her spell fell over them. I reach for my pipes, not knowing if I am out of line as I fumble them to my lips. Doesn't matter. Couldn't stop myself if I wanted. Something primal compels me to join the song. Roshva nods as I blow the first notes, weaving my piping around her voice. She begins to test me, changing key and altering the pace, but following her is effortless, like following her scent through the hedge maze in the Krasian Palace Gardens when we were kids. I want to laugh at the joy of it.
Rosevere turns her attention back to the demons, taking the song up an octave, and then another, her voice going higher than any voice has a right to. I don't even have to look at the demons to know the effect she is creating. I feel it in my stones. The demons shriek and run for their lives. The four I originally spotted, and three more out on the flats that had been slowly inching our way. Their fear is so all-encompassing, it may be miles before they stop running, and they will be reluctant to return. Rosevere turns my way, and I see her smile as she tests my limits, taking the song to new and difficult places just to see if I can follow. She's better than me, far better, but I refuse to fall behind, going wherever her voice leads.
"Aye, enough with the racket,"
Selin says, after what could have been hours or mere minutes. Rosevere and I both break off, turning to her in surprise. I can smell her irritation, sharp and hot. But I don't know the cause.
"Demons are gone,"
Selin says. "Ain't any point in playing all night. Going to need our rest come morning."
"What if they come back?" I ask.
Selin reaches into her pack, pulling out Olive's Cloak of Unsight. Unlike the famed multicoloured cloak of Rosier Halfgrip, this one is midnight blue, almost black, and its wards look like silver fire. She goes to Arik. "This belongs to Olive, but I don't think she'd mind you using it until we can return it to her." Arik reaches out, and her hands touch for a little too long as he takes the cloak from her. "You honour me, Selin Var Garad. One day I will give you a gift of equal value in return."
"You already have," Selin says.
"Coming along with us." They stare at each other a while longer. Then she turns away, shivering as she slips into her bedroll, draping her own cloak over her. The mood shattered, I drop my pipes, letting them hang from the strap.
"Didn't know you could do that," I tell Rosevere.
"You make my pipe sound like a dented bugle." "Nonsense," Rosevere says, but she smiles again. "My brother resents our father's legacy, but I do not. Rosia Asu Jessum was bound in greater glory than the warriors Arik idolizes. Even Arik's mother was known more for her song than her work with the spear.
And why don't you be the jongleur and let Arik wear the black?"
I ask quietly. Arik and Selin are both in their bedrolls, but I can hear their hearts and breath. Both are awake and listening.
"Because Arik is the sun."
Roshva's hiss is low and venomous.
"And I am my mother's heir. Set to one day succeed her as the Maji Ting of the Kaji tribe."
"Doesn't sound so bad," I say. Rosevere surprises me by spitting in the dust. She turns away, looking out over the empty orange flats. "I would have been a great jongleur. Like my father, the Royal Herald, I could be the voice of the Shah Dama Ka and Damaja in foreign lands. A diva, stylish in my coloured gowns, voice known far and wide with lovers in every court." She looks down at her white robes. "Instead, I am given plain white and told my body belongs to Everarm."